he said.
"Grolio," one of the locusts replied.
"I have more locusts, if you need them," said Scarhaz.
"Six should serve. What are the men on the doors?"
"Mine. You will have no trouble."
Sebastian clasped the shapefate by the arm.
"Shed no blood unless you must. Come the morrow we will convene a council and tell the city what we have done and why."
"As you say. Good fortune to you, old man."
They went their separate ways. The brazen beasts fell in behind Sir Barristan as he continued his descent. The king's apartments were buried in the very heart of the pyramid, on the 16th and 17th levels. When Selmy reached those floors, he found the doors to the interior of the pyramid chained shut, with a pair of brazen beasts posted as guards. Beneath the hoods of their patchwork cloaks, one was a rat, the other a bull.
"Grolio," Sir Barristan said.
"Grolio," the bull returned.
"Sir Dol to the right."
The rat unlocked the chain. Sir Barristan and his escort stepped through into a narrow, torch-lit servants' corridor of red and black brick. Their footsteps echoed on the floors as they strode past two halls and took the third one to the right. Outside the carved hardwood doors to the king's chambers stood Steelskin, a younger pit-fighter not yet regarded as of the first rank. His cheeks and brow were scarred with intricate tattoos in green and black, ancient Valyrian sorcerer's signs that supposedly made his flesh and skin as hard as steel. Similar markings covered his chest and arms, though whether they would actually stop a sword or axe remained to be seen. Even without them, Steelskin looked formidable, a lean and wiry youth who overtopped Sir Barristan by half a foot.
"Who goes there?"
he called out, swinging his long axe sideways to bar their way. When he saw Sir Barristan, with the brass locust behind him, he lowered it again.
"Old sir!"
"If it please the king, I must needs have words with him."
"The hour is late."
"The hour is late, but the need is urgent."
"I can ask."
Steelskin slammed the butt of his long axe against the door to the king's apartments. A slide hole opened. A child's eye appeared. A child's voice called through the door. Steelskin replied. Sir Barristan heard the sound of a heavy bar being drawn back. The door swung open.
"Only you," said Steelskin. "The beasts wait here."
"As you wish."
Sir Barristan nodded to the locusts. One returned his nod. Alone, Selmy slipped through the door. Dark and windowless, surrounded on all sides by brick walls 8 feet thick, the chambers that the king had made his own were large and luxurious within. Great beams of black oak supported the high ceilings. The floors were covered with silk carpets out of Carth. On the walls were priceless tapestries, ancient and much faded, depicting the glory of the old empire of Gis. The largest of them showed the last survivors of a defeated Valyrian army, passing beneath the yoke and being chained. The archway leading to the royal bedchamber was guarded by a pair of sandalwood lovers, shaped and smoothed and oiled. Sir Barristan found them distasteful, though no doubt they were meant to be arousing.
"The sooner we are gone from this place, the better."
An iron brazier gave the only light. Beside it stood two of the queen's cupbearers, Drakhaz and Keza.
"Miklas has gone to wake the king," said Keza. "May we bring you wine, sir?"
No, thank you."
"You may sit,"
said Drakhaz, indicating a bench.
"I prefer to stand."
He could hear voices drifting through the archway from the bedchamber. One of them was the king's. It was still a good few moments before King Hesdar Zolorek, 14th of that noble name, emerged yawning, knotting the sash that closed his robe. The robe was green satin, richly worked with pearls and silver thread. Under it the king was quite naked. That was good. Naked men felt vulnerable and were less inclined to acts of suicidal heroism. The woman Sir Barristan glimpsed, peering through the archway from behind a gauzy curtain, was naked as well, her breasts and hips only partially concealed by the blowing silk.
"Eh, Sir Barristan,"
Hisdar yawned again.
"What hour is it? Is there news of my sweet queen?"
"None, Your Grace."
Hisdar sighed.
"Your magnificence, please. Though at this hour, your sleepiness would be more apt."
The king crossed to the sideboard to pour himself a cup of wine, but only a trickle remained in the bottom of the flagon. A flicker of annoyance crossed his face.
"Miklas, wine at once."
"Yes, Your Worship."
"Take Drakkar's with you. One flagon of Arbor Gold and one of that sweet red. None of your yellow piss, thank you. And the next time I find my flagon dry, I may have to take a switch to those pretty pink cheeks of yours."
The boy went running off, and the king turned back to Selmy.
"I dreamed you found Daenerys."
"Dreams can lie, Your Grace."
"Your radiance would serve." "What brings you to me at this hour, sir? Some trouble in the city?"
"The city is tranquil."
"Is it so?"
Hisdar looked confused.
"Why have you come?"
"To ask a question.
Magnificence, are you the harpy?"
Hisdar's wine cup slipped through his fingers, bounced off the carpet, rolled.
"You come to my bedchamber in the black of night and ask me that. Are you mad?"
It was only then that the king seemed to notice that Sir Barristan was wearing his plate and mail.
"What, why, how dare you? Was the poison your work, magnificence?"
King Hisdar backed away a step.
"The locust, that was the Dornish man. Quentin, the so-called prince. Ask Resnick, if you doubt me."
"Have you proof of that? Has Resnick?"
"No, else I would have had them seized. Perhaps I should do so in any case. Margaz will wring a confession out of them. I do not doubt. They're all poisonous, these Dornish. Resnick says they worship snakes."
"They eat snakes," said Sir Barristan. "It was your pit, your bucks, your seats, sweet wine and soft cushions, figs and melons and honeyed locusts. You provided all. You urged Her Grace to try the locusts, but never tasted one yourself."
Hot spices do not agree with me. She was my wife, my queen. Why would I want to poison her?"
"Was," he says. "He believes her dead."
"Only you can answer that, magnificence. It might be that you wish to put another woman in her place."
Sir Barristan nodded at the girl peering timidly from the bedchamber.
"That one, perhaps."
The king looked round wildly.
She's nothing. A bed slave."
He raised his hands. "I misspoke. Not a slave. A free woman, trained in pleasure. Even a king has needs. She
is none of your concern, sir. I would never harm Daenerys, never."
"You urged the queen to try the locusts. I heard you."
"I thought she might enjoy them."
Hisdar retreated another step.
"Hot and sweet at once."
"Hot and sweet and poisoned. With mine own ears I heard you commanding the men in the pit to kill Drogon, shouting at them." Hisdar licked his lips. "The beast devoured Basenna's flesh. Dragons prey on men. It was killing, burning. Burning men who meant harm to your queen. Harpy sons, as like as not. Your friends."
"Not my friends."
"You say that. Yet when you told them to stop killing, they obeyed. Why would they do that if you were not one of them?" Hisdar shook his head. This time he did not answer.
"Tell me true," Sir Barristan said. "Did you ever love her? Even a little? Or was it just the crown you lusted for?"
"Lust? You dare speak to me of lust?"
The king's mouth twisted in anger.
"I lusted for the crown, aye, but not half so much as she lusted for her sellsword. Perhaps it was her precious captain who tried to poison her, for putting him aside. And if I had eaten of his locust too, well, so much the better."
Dario is a killer, but not a poisoner. Sir Barristan moved closer to the king. Are you the harpy? This time he put his hand on the hilt of his longsword.
Tell me true, and I promise you shall have a swift, clean death.
You presume too much, sir, said Hisdar. I am done with these questions, and with you. You are dismissed for my service. Leave Meereen at once, and I will let you live.
If you are not the harpy, give me his name.
Sir Barristan pulled his sword from the scabbard. Its sharp edge caught the light from the brazier, became a line of orange fire. Hisdar broke.
Kroz! He shrieked, stumbling backwards toward his bedchamber. Kroz! Kroz!
Sir Barristan heard a door open somewhere to his left. He turned in time to see Kroz emerge from behind a tapestry. He moved slowly, still groggy from sleep, but his weapon of choice was in his hand, a Dothraki Arak, long and curved, a slasher sword, made to deliver deep, slicing cuts from horseback. A murderer's blade against half-naked foes, in the pit or on the battlefield. But here at close quarters, the Arak's length would tell against it, and Barristan Selmy was clad in plate and mail.
"I am here for Hisdar," the knight said. "Throw down your steel and stand aside, and no harm need come to you."
Kroz laughed.
"Old man, I will eat your heart."
The two men were of a height, but Kroz was 2 stone heavier and 40 years younger, with pale skin, dead eyes, and a crest of bristly red-black hair that ran from his brow to the base of his neck.
"Then come," said Barristan the Bold.
Kroz came. For the first time all day, Selmy felt certain. "This is what I was made for," he thought. "The dance, the sweet steel song, a sword in my hand and a foe before me." The pit fighter was fast, blazing fast, as quick as any man Sir Barristan had ever fought. In those big hands the Arak became a whistling blur, a steel storm that seemed to come at the old knight from 3 directions at once. Most of the cuts were aimed at his head. Kroz was no fool. Without a helm, Selmy was most vulnerable above the neck. He blocked the blows calmly, his longsword meeting each slash and turning it aside. The blades rang and rang again. Sir Barristan retreated. On the edge of his vision, he saw the cupbearers watching with eyes as big and white as chicken eggs. Kroz cursed and turned a high cut into a low one, slipping past the old knight's blade for once, only to have his blow scraped uselessly off a white steel greave. Selmy's answering slash found the pit fighter's left shoulder, parting the fine linen to bite the flesh beneath. His yellow tunic began to turn pink, then red.
"Only cowards dress in iron," Kroz declared, circling.
No one wore armor in the fighting pits. It was blood the crowds came for, death, dismemberment, and shrieks of agony, the music of the Scarlet Sands.
Sir Barristan turned with him. "This coward is about to kill you, sir."
The man was no knight, but his courage had earned him that much courtesy. Kroz did not know how to fight a man in armor. Sir Barristan could see it in his eyes, doubt, confusion, the beginnings of fear. The pit fighter came on again, screaming this time, as if Saan could slay his foe where steel could not. The Arak slashed low, high, low again. Selmy blocked the cuts at his head and let his armor stop the rest, whilst his own blade opened the pit fighter's cheek from ear to mouth, then traced a raw red gash across his chest. Blood welled from Kroz's wounds. That only seemed to make him wilder. He seized the brazier with his offhand and flipped it, scattering embers and hot coals at Selmy's feet. Sir Barristan leapt over them. Kroz slashed at his arm and caught him, but the Arak could only chip the hard enamel before it met the steel below.
"In the pit, that would have taken your arm off, old man."
"We are not in the pit.
Take off that armor.
It is not too late to throw down your steel. Yield."
"Die," spat Kroz.
But as he lifted his Arak, its tip grazed one of the wall hangings and hung. That was all the chance of Barristan required. He slashed open the pit fighter's belly, parried the arrack as it wrenched free, then finished Kraus with a quick thrust of the heart as the pit fighter's entrails came sliding out like a nest of greasy eels. Blood and viscera stained the king's silk carpets. Selme took a step back. The longsword in his hand was red for half its length. Here and there the carpets had begun to smoulder, where some of the scattered coals had fallen. He could hear poor Kessa sobbing.
"Don't be afraid," the old knight said. "I mean you no harm, child. I want only the king."
He wiped his sword clean on a curtain and stalked into the bedchamber, where he found Hisda Zolorek, 14th of his noble name, hiding behind a tapestry and whimpering.
"Spare me," he begged. "I do not want to die."
"Few do, yet all men die regardless." Sir Barristan sheathed his sword and pulled Hisda to his feet.
"Come, I will escort you to a cell."
By now the brazen beasts should have disarmed Steelskin.
"You will be kept a prisoner until the queen returns. If nothing can be proved against you, you will not come to harm. You have my word as a knight."
He took the king's arm and led him from the bedchamber, feeling strangely light-headed, almost drunk.
"Now I was a king's guard. What am I now?"
Miklas and Drakas had returned with Hisdar's wine. They stood in the open door, cradling the flagons against their chests and staring wide-eyed at the corpse of Kraus. Kessa was still crying, but Yazin had appeared to comfort her. She hugged the younger girl, stroking her hair. Some of the other cupbearers stood behind them, watching.
"Your worship," Miklas said, "the noble Resnak Mo Resnak says to tell you, come at once."
The boy addressed the king as if Sir Barristan were not there, as if there were no dead man sprawled upon the carpet, his life's blood slowly staining the silk red.
"Skarhaz was supposed to take Resnik into custody until we could be certain of his loyalty. Had something gone awry?"
"Come where?" Sir Barristan asked the boy. "Where does the seneschal want his grace to go?"
"Outside."
Miklas seemed to see him for the first time.
"Outside, sir, to the terrace, to see."
"To see what?"
Dragons. The dragons have been loose, sir."
"Seven save us all," the old knight thought.
The Dragon Tamer. The night crept past on slow black feet. The R of the bat gave way to the R of the eel, the R of the eel to the R of ghosts. The prince lay abed, staring at his ceiling, dreaming without sleeping, remembering, imagining, twisting beneath his linen coverlet, his mind feverish with thoughts of fire and blood. Finally, despairing of rest, Quentin Martell made his way to his solar, where he poured himself a cup of wine and drank it in the dark. The taste was sweet solace on his tongue, so he lit a candle and poured himself another.
"Wine will help me sleep," he told himself, but he knew that was a lie.
He stared at the candle for a long time, then put down his cup and held his palm above the flame. It took every bit of will he had to lower it until the fire touched his flesh, and when it did, he snatched his hand back with a cry of pain.
"Quentin, are you mad?"
"No, just scared. I do not want to burn."
"Geras, I heard you moving about. I could not sleep. A burn's a cure for that. Some warm milk and a lullaby might serve you well. Or better still, I could take you to the Temple of the Graces and find a girl for you."
"A whore, you mean?" "They call them graces. They come in different colors. The red ones are the only ones who fuck." Geras seated himself across the table. "The scepters back home should take up the custom, if you ask me. Have you noticed that old scepters always look like prunes? That's what a life of chastity will do to you." Quentin glanced out of the terrace, where night shadows lay thick amongst the trees. He could hear the soft sound of falling water.
"Is that rain? Your horse will be gone."
"Not all of them. There are little snuggeries in the pleasure gardens, and they wait there every night until a man chooses them. Those who are not chosen must remain until the sun comes up, feeling lonely and neglected. We could console them."
"They could console me, is what you mean."
"That too. That is not the sort of consolation I require."
"I disagree. Daenerys Targaryen is not the only woman in the world. Do you want to die a man-maid?"
Quentin did not want to die at all.
"I want to go back to Ironwood and kiss both of your sisters, marry Gwyneth Ironwood, watch her flower into beauty, have a child by her. I want to ride in tourneys, hawk and hunt, visit with my mother in Novus, read some of those books my father sends me. I want Cletus and Will and Maester Kedri to be alive again."
"Do you think Daenerys would be pleased to hear that I had bedded some whore?"
"She might be. Men may be fond of maidens, but women like a man who knows what he's about in the bedchamber. It's another sort of sword play. Takes training to be good at it."
The jibe stung. Quentin had never felt so much a boy as when he stood before Daenerys Targaryen, pleading for her hand. The thought of bedding her terrified him, almost as much as her dragon's head. What if he could not please her?
"Daenerys has a paramour," he said defensively. "My father did not send me here to amuse the queen in the bedchamber. You know why we have come."
"They cannot marry her. She has a husband."
"She does not love Hisdar Zolorik."
"What has love to do with marriage?
A prince should know better. Your father married for love, it said. How much joy has he had of that?"
"Little and less. Doran Martell and his Norvoshi wife had spent half their marriage apart and the other half arguing. It was the only rash thing his father had ever done, to hear some tell it. The only time he had followed his heart instead of his head, and he had lived to rue it."
"Not all risks lead to ruin," he insisted. "This is my duty, my destiny."
"You are supposed to be my friend, Garrus. Why must you mock my hopes? I have doubts enough without your throwing oil on the fire of my fear."
"This will be my grand adventure. Men die on grand adventures."
He was not wrong. That was in the stories, too. The hero sets out with his friends and companions, faces dangers, comes home triumphant. Only some of his companions don't return at all.
"The hero never dies, though. I must be the hero.
All I need is courage. Would you have Dorn remember me as a failure?"
"Dorn is not like to remember any of us for long."
Quentin sucked at the burn spot on his palm.
"Dorn remembers Egan and his sisters. Dragons are not so easily forgotten. They will remember Daenerys as well."
"Not if she's died."
"She lives."
"She must.
She has lust, but I can find her. And when I do, she will look at me the way she looks at her sellsword, once I have proven myself worthy of her."
"From Dragonback?
I have been riding horses since I was 6 years old."
"And you've been thrown a time or three?"
"That never stopped me from getting back into the saddle."
"You've never been thrown off 1,000 feet above the ground," Garrus pointed out, "and horses seldom turn their riders into charred bones and ashes."
"I knew the dangers."
"I'll hear no more of this. You have my leave to go. Find a ship and run home, Garrus."
The prince rose, blew the candle out, and crept back to his bed, and its sweat-soaked linen sheets.
"I should have kissed one of the Drinkwater twins, or maybe both of them. I should have kissed them whilst they could. I should have gone to Norvus to see my mother and the place that gave her birth, so she would know that I had not forgotten her."
He could hear the rain falling outside, drumming against the bricks. By the time the Eye of the Wolf crept upon them, the rain was falling steadily, slashing down in a hard, cold torrent that would soon turn the brick streets of Meereen into rivers. The three Dornishmen broke their fast in the pre-dawn chill. A simple meal of fruit and bread and cheese, washed down with goat milk. When Gerrus made to pour himself a cup of wine, Quentin stopped him.
"No wine. There will be time enough for drink afterward."
"One hopes," said Gerrus.
The big man looked out toward the terrace.
"I knew it would rain," he said in a gloomy tone. "My bones were aching last night. They always ache before it rains. The dragons won't like this. Fire and water don't mix, and that's a fact. You get a good cook fire lit, blazing away nice, then it starts to piss down rain, and next thing your wood is sudden and your flames are dead."
Gerrus chuckled. "Dragons are not made of wood, Arch."
"Some are. That old King Aegon, the randy one, he built wooden dragons to conquer us. That ended bad, though."
"So may this," the prince thought. The follies and failures of Aegon the Unworthy did not concern him, but he was full of doubts and misgivings. The laboured banter of his friends was only making his head ache.
"They do not understand. They may be Dornish, but I am Dorn. Years from now, when I am dead, this will be the song they sing of me."
He rose abruptly. "It's time." His friends got to their feet. Sir Archibald drained the last of his goat's milk and wiped the milk moustache from his upper lip with the back of a big hand.
"I'll get our mama's gob."
He returned with a bundle they had collected from the tattered prince at their second meeting. Within were three long hooded cloaks, made from myriad small squares of cloth sewn together. Three cudgels, three short swords, three masks of polished brass, a bull, a lion, and an ape. Everything required to be a brazen beast. "They may ask for a word," the tattered prince had warned them when he handed over the bundle. "It's dog." "You are certain of that?" Gerrus had asked him. "Certain enough to wager a life upon it." The prince did not mistake his meaning. "My life. That would be the one." "How did you learn their word?" "We chanced upon some brazen beasts, and Merus asked them prettily. But a prince should know better than to pose such questions, Dornish. In Pentos we have a saying, never ask the baker what went into the pie. Just eat."
"Just eat?"
There was wisdom in that, Quentin supposed.
"I'll be the bull," Arch announced.
Quentin handed him the bull mask. "The lion for me, which makes a monkey out of me." Gerrus pressed the ape mask to his face.
"How do they breathe in these things?"
"Just put it on."
The prince was in no mood for japes. The bundle contained a whip as well, a nasty piece of old leather with a handle of brass and bone, stout enough to peel the hide off an ox.
"What's that for?" Arch asked.
"Daenerys used a whip to cow the black beast." Quentin coiled the whip and hung it from his belt. "Arch, bring your hammer as well. We may have need of it." It was no easy thing to enter the great pyramid of Meereen by night. The doors were closed and barred each day at sunset, and remained closed until first light. Guards were posted at every entrance, and more guards patrolled the lowest terrace, where they could look down on the street. Formerly those guards had been unsolid. Now they were brazen beasts. And that would make all the difference, Quentin hoped. The watch changed when the sun came up, but dawn was still half an hour off as the three Dornishmen made their way down the servant steps. The walls around them were made of bricks of half a hundred colours, but the shadows turned them all to grey until touched by the light of the torch that Gerrus carried. They encountered no one on the long descent. The only sound was the scuff of their boots on the worn bricks beneath their feet. The pyramid's main gates fronted on Meereen's central plaza, but the Dornishmen made their way to a side entrance, opening on an alley. These were the gates that slaves had used in former days as they went about their master's business, where small folk and tradesmen came and went and made their deliveries. The doors were solid bronze, closed with a heavy iron bar. Before them stood two brazen beasts,
armed with cudgels, spears, and short swords. Torchlight glimmered off the polished brass of their masks, a rat and a fox. Quentin gestured for the big man to stay back in the shadows. He and Garrus strode forward together.
"You come early,"
the fox said. Quentin shrugged.
"We can leave again if you like. You're welcome to stand our watch."
He sounded not at all Gascari, he knew. But half the brazen beasts were freed slaves, with all manner of native tongues. So his accent went unremarked.
"Bugger that," the rat remarked. "Give us the day's word," said the fox.
"Dug," said the Dornishman. The two brazen beasts exchanged a look. For three long heartbeats, Quentin was afraid that something had gone amiss, that somehow Pretty Maris and the tattered prince had gotten the word wrong. Then the fox grunted.
"Dog, then," he said. "The door is yours."
As they moved off, the prince began to breathe again. They did not have long. The real relief would doubtless turn up shortly. "Arch," he called, and the big man appeared, the torchlight shining off his bull's mask.
"The bar, hurry."
The iron bar was thick and heavy, but well oiled. Sir Archibald had no trouble lifting it. As he was standing at on end, Quentin pulled the doors open, and Garrus stepped through, waving the torch.
"Bring it in now. Be quick about it."
The butcher's wagon was outside, waiting in the alley. The driver gave the mule a lick and rumbled through, iron-rimmed wheels clacking loudly over bricks. The quartered carcass of an ox filled the wagon bed, along with two dead sheep. Half a dozen men entered afoot. Five wore the cloaks and masks of brazen beasts, but Pretty Maris had not troubled to disguise herself.
"Where is your lord?"
he asked Maris.
"I have no lord," she answered. "If you mean your fellow prince, he is near with 50 men. Bring your dragon out, and he will see you safe away, as promised. Cago commands here."
Sir Archibald was giving the butcher's wagon a sour eye.
"Will that cart be big enough to hold a dragon?" he asked.
"Should. It's held 2 oxen.
The corpse-killer was garbed as a brazen beast, his seamed, scarred face hidden behind a cobra mask, but the familiar black arrack slung at his hip gave him away.
"We were told these beasts are smaller than the Queen's monster."
"The pit has slowed their growth." Quentin's readings had suggested that the same thing had occurred in the Seven Kingdoms. None of the dragons bred and raised in the dragon pit of King's Landing had ever approached the size of Vhagar or Meraxes, much less that of the Black Dread, King Aegon's monster.
"Have you brought sufficient chains?"
"How many dragons do you have?" said Pretty Maris. "We have chains enough for 10, concealed beneath the meat."
"Very good." Quentin felt light-headed. None of this seemed quite real. One moment it felt like a game, and the next like some nightmare, like a bad dream where he found himself opening a dark door, knowing that horror and death waited on the other side, yet somehow powerless to stop himself. His palms were slick with sweat. He wiped them on his legs and said, "There will be more guards outside the pit."
"We know," said Garrus. "We need to be ready for them."
"We are," said Arch.
There was a cramp in Quentin's belly. He felt a sudden need to move his bowels, but knew he dare not beg off now.
"This way, then."
He had seldom felt more like a boy. Yet they followed, Garrus and the big man, Maris and Cago, and the other windblown. Two of the sellswords had produced crossbows from some hiding place within the wagon. Beyond the stables, the ground level of the Great Pyramid became a labyrinth, but Quentin Martell had been through here with the Queen, and he remembered the way. Under 3 huge brick arches they went, then down a steep stone ramp into the depths, through the dungeons and torture chambers, and past a pair of deep stone cisterns. Their footsteps echoed hollowly off the walls, the butcher's cart rumbling behind them. The big man snatched a torch down from a wall sconce to lead the way. At last a pair of heavy iron doors rose before them, rust-eaten
and forbidding, clothes with a length of chain whose every link was as thick around as a man's arm. The size and thickness of those doors was enough to make Quentin Martell question the wisdom of this course. Even worse, both doors were plainly dinted by something inside trying to get out. The thick iron was cracked and splitting in three places, and the upper corner of the left-hand door looked partly melted. Four brazen beasts stood guarding the door. Three held long spears. The fourth, the sergeant, was armed with short sword and dagger. His mask was wrought in the shape of a basilisk's head. The other three were masked as insects. "Locusts," Quentin realized. "Doug," he said. The sergeant stiffened. That was all it took for Quentin Martell to realize that something had gone awry. "Take them," he croaked, even as the basilisk's hand darted for his short sword. He was quick, that sergeant. The big man was quicker. He flung the torch at the nearest locust, reached back, and unslung his warhammer. The basilisk blade had scarce slipped from its leather sheath when the hammer spike slammed into his temple, crunching through the thin brass of his mask and the flesh and bone beneath. The sergeant staggered sideways half a step before his knees folded onto him and he sank down to the floor, his whole body shaking grotesquely. Quentin stared transfixed, his belly roiling. His own blade was still in its sheath. He had not so much as reached for it. His eyes were locked on the sergeant dying before him, jerking. The fallen torch was on the floor, guttering, making every shadow leap and twist in a monstrous mockery of the dead man's shaking. The prince never saw the locust spear coming toward him until Geras slammed into him, knocking him aside. The spear point grazed the cheek of the lion's head he wore. Even then, the blow was so violent it almost tore the mask off. "It would have gone right through my throat," the prince thought, dazed. Geras cursed as the locusts closed around him. Quentin heard the sound of running feet. Then the sellswords came rushing from the shadows. One of the guards glanced at them just long enough for Geras to get inside his spear. He drove the point of his sword under the brass mask and up through the wearer's throat, even as the second locust sprouted a crossbow bolt from his chest. The last locust dropped his spear.
"Yield, or yield!"
"No, ye die!" Kago took the man's head off with one swipe of his arrow, the Valyrian steel shearing through flesh and bone and gristle, as if they were so much suet.
"Too much noise," he complained. "Any man with ears will have heard."
"Doug," Quentin said. "The day's word was supposed to be Doug. Why wouldn't they let us pass? We were told."
"You were told? Your scheme was madness. Have you forgotten?" said Pretty Maris. "Do what you came to do."
"The dragons," Prince Quentin thought.
"Yes, we came for the dragons."
He felt as though he might be sick.
"What am I doing here? Farther away."
"Four men dead in as many heartbeats, and for what?"
"Fire and blood," he whispered. "Blood and fire."
The blood was pooling at his feet, soaking into the brick floor. The fire was beyond those doors.
"The chains. We have no key."
Arch said, "I have the key."
He swung his warhammer hard and fast. Sparks flew when the hammerhead struck the lock. And then again, again, again. On his fifth swing, the lock shattered, and the chains fell away in a rattling clatter so loud Quentin was certain half the pyramid must have heard them.
"Bring the cart." The dragons would be more docile once fed. "Let them gorge themselves on charred mutton."
Archibald Ironwood grasped the iron doors and pulled them apart. Their rusty hinges let out a pair of screams for all those who might have slept through the breaking of the lock. A wash of sudden heat assaulted them, heavy with the odors of ash, brimstone, and burnt meat. It was black beyond the doors, a sullen, Stygian darkness that seemed alive and threatening, hungry. Quentin could sense that there was something in that darkness, coiled and waiting. "Warrior, grant me courage," he prayed. He did not want to do this, but he saw no other way. Why else would Daenerys have shown me the dragons? She wants me to prove myself to her.
Garrus handed him a torch. He stepped through the doors.
The green one is Rhaegal, the white Viserion, he reminded himself. Use their names. Command them. Speak to them calmly but sternly. Master them, as Daenerys mastered Drogon in the pit.
The girl had been alone, clad in wisps of silk, but fearless.
I must not be afraid. She did it. So can I.
The main thing was to show no fear.
Animals can smell fear, and dragons.
What did he know of dragons?
What does any man know of dragons? They have been gone from the world for more than a century.
The lip of the pit was just ahead. Quentin edged forward slowly, moving the torch from side to side. Walls and floor and ceiling drank the light.
Scorched, he realized. Bricks burnt black, crumbling into ash.
The air grew warmer with every step he took. He began to sweat. Two eyes rose up before him. Bronze they were, brighter than polished shields, glowing with their own heat, burning behind a veil of smoke rising from the dragon's nostrils. The light of Quentin's torch washed over scales of dark green, the green of moss in the deep woods at dusk, just before the last light fades. Then the dragon opened its mouth, and light and heat washed over them. Behind a fence of sharp black teeth, he glimpsed the furnace glow, the shimmer of a sleeping fire, 100 times brighter than his torch. The dragon's head was larger than a horse's, and the neck stretched on and on, uncoiling like some great green serpent, as the head rose until those two glowing bronze eyes were staring down at him.
Green, the prince thought. His scales are green. Rhaegal, he said, his voice caught in his throat, and what came out was a broken croak. Frog, he thought. I'm turning into frog again.
The food, he croaked, remembering. Bring the food. The big man heard him. Arch wrestled one of the sheep off the wagon by two legs, then spun and flung it into the pit. Rhaegal took it in the air. His head snapped round, and from between his jaws a lance of flame erupted. A swirling storm of orange and yellow fire shot through with veins of green. The sheep was burning before it began to fall. Before the smoking carcass could strike the bricks, the dragon's teeth closed round it. A nimbus of flames still flickered about the body. The air stank of burning wool and brimstone. Dragon stink.
I thought there were two, the big man said.
Viserion, yes. Where is Viserion?
The prince lowered his torch to throw some light into the gloom below. He could see the green dragon ripping at the smoking carcass of the sheep, his long tail lashing from side to side as he ate. A thick iron collar was visible about his neck, with 3 feet of broken chain dangling from it. Shattered links were strewn across the floor of the pit amongst the blackened bones, twists of metal, partly melted. Rhaegal was chained to the wall and floor the last time I was here, the prince recalled, but Viserion hung from the ceiling. Quentin stepped back, lifted the torch, craned his head back. For a moment he saw only the blackened arches of the bricks above, scorched by dragon flame. A trickle of ash caught his eye, betraying movement. Something pale, half-hidden, stirring. He's made himself a cave, the prince realized. A burrow in the brick. The foundations of the great pyramid of Meereen were massive and thick to support the weight of the huge structure overhead. Even the interior walls were 3 times thicker than any castle's curtain walls. But Viserion had dug himself a hole in them with flame and claw, a hole big enough to sleep in.
And we've just woken him. He could see what looked like some huge white serpent uncoiling inside the wall. Upward it curved to become the ceiling. More ash went drifting downward, and a bit of crumbling brick fell away. The serpent resolved itself
into a neck and tail, and then the dragon's long horned head appeared, his eyes glowing in the dark like golden coals. His wings rattled, stretching. All of Quentin's plans had fled his head. He could hear Kago Korpskiller shouting to his cell thoughts. "The chains! He is sending for the chains," the Dornish prince thought. The plan had been to feed the beasts and chain them in their torpor, just as the queen had done. One dragon, or preferably both. "More meat," Quentin said. "Once the beasts were fed, they will become sluggish." He had seen it work with snakes in Dawn, but here, with these monsters, "Bring, bring!" The Viserion launched himself from the ceiling, pale leather wings unfolding, spreading wide. The broken chain dangling from his neck swung wildly. His flame lit the pit. Pale gold shot through with red and orange, and the stale air exploded in a cloud of hot ash and sulphur as the white wings beat and beat again. A hand seized Quentin by the shoulder. The torch spun from his grip to bounce across the floor, then tumbled into the pit, still burning. He found himself face to face with a brass ape, Geras. "Quent, this will not work. They're too wild. The dragon came down between the Dornish men and the door with a roar that would have sent 100 lions running. His head moved side to side as he inspected the intruders. Dornishman, windblown, Kago. Last and longest, the beast stared at pretty Maris, sniffing. The woman, Quentin realized. He knows that she is female. He's looking for Daenerys. He wants his mother and does not understand why she's not here. Quentin wrenched free of Garrus' grip. "Viserion," he called. "The white one is Viserion." For half a heartbeat, he was afraid he'd gotten it wrong. "Viserion," he called again, fumbling for the whip hanging from his belt. "She cowed the black one with a whip. I need to do the same." The dragon knew his name. His head turned, and his gaze lingered on the Dornish prince for 3 long heartbeats. Pale fires burned behind the shining black daggers of his teeth. His eyes were lakes of molten gold, and smoke rose from his nostrils. "Down!" Quentin said. Then he coughed, and coughed again. The air was thick with smoke, and the sulphur stench was choking. Viserion lost interest. The dragon turned back toward the windblown and lurched toward the door. Perhaps he could smell the blood of the dead guards, or the meat in the butcher's wagon, or perhaps he had only now seen that the way was open. Quentin heard the cell sword shouting. Kago was calling for the chains, and pretty Maris was screaming at someone to step aside. The dragon moved awkwardly on the ground, like a man scrabbling on his knees and elbows, but quicker than the Dornish prince would have believed. When the windblown were too late to get out of his way, Viserion let loose with another roar. Quentin heard the rattle of chains, the deep thrum of a crossbow. "No!" he screamed. "No, don't! Don't!" But it was too late. "The fool!" was all that he had time to think as the quarrel caromed off Viserion's neck to vanish in the gloom. A line of fire gleamed in its wake. Dragon's blood, glowing gold and red. The crossbowman was fumbling for another quarrel as the dragon's teeth closed round his neck. The man wore the mask of a brazen beast, the fearsome likeness of a tiger. As he dropped his weapon to try and pry apart Viserion's jaws, flame gouted from the tiger's mouth. The man's eyes burst with soft popping sounds, and the brass around them began to run. The dragon tore off a hunk of flesh, most of the sellsword's neck, then gulped it down as the burning corpse collapsed to the floor. The other windblown were pulling back. This was more than even Pretty Maris had the stomach for. The Viserion's horned head moved back and forth between them and his prey, but after a moment he forgot the sellswords and bent his neck to tear another mouthful from the dead man, a lower leg this time. Quentin let his whip uncoil. "Viserion!" he called, louder this time.
He could do this. He would do this. His father had sent him to the far ends of the earth for this. He would not fail him. Viserion! He snapped the whip in the air with a crack that echoed off the blackened walls. The pale head rose. The great gold eyes narrowed. Wisps of smoke spiraled upward from the dragon's nostrils. Down! The prince commanded. You must not let him smell your fear. Down! 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 He brought the whip around and laid a lash across the dragon's face. Viserion hissed. And then a hot wind buffeted him, and he heard the sound of leathern wings, and the air was full of ash and cinders, and a monstrous roar went echoing off the scorched and blackened bricks, and he could hear his friends shouting wildly. Garrus was calling out his name over and over, and the big man was bellowing,
"Behind you! Behind you! Behind you!"
Quentin turned and threw his left arm across his face to shield his eyes from the furnace wind.
Regal, he reminded himself. The green one is Regal.
When he raised his whip, he saw that the lash was burning, his hand as well. All of him was burning.
Ooh, he thought.
Then he began to scream. John.
"Let them die," said Queen Selyse.
It was the answer that John Snow had expected. This queen never fails to disappoint. Somehow that did not soften the blow. "Your Grace," he persisted stubbornly, "they are starving at Hardhome by the thousands. Many are women."
"And children, yes, very sad."
The queen pulled her daughter closer to her and kissed her cheek. The cheek unmarred by grayscale, John did not fail to note.
"We are sorry for the little ones, of course, but we must be sensible. We have no food for them, and they are too young to help the king, my husband, in his wars. Better that they be reborn into the light."
That was just a softer way of saying, "Let them die." The chamber was crowded. Princess Shireen stood beside her mother's seat, with Patchface cross-legged at her feet. Behind the queen loomed Sir Axel Florent. Melisandre of Ashai stood closer to the fire, the ruby at her throat pulsing with every breath she took. The Red Woman, too, had her attendants, the squire Devon Seaworth, and two of the guardsmen the king had left her. Queen Selyse's protectors stood along the walls, shining knights all in a row. Sir Malagorn, Sir Benathon, Sir Narbert, Sir Patrick, Sir Dordan, Sir Bros. With so many bloodthirsty wildlings infesting Castle Black, Selyse kept her sworn shields about her night and day. Tormund Giantsbane had roared to hear it.
"Afraid of being carried off, you see? I hope you never said how big me member is, John Snow. That'd frighten any woman. I always wanted me one with a moustache."
Then he laughed and laughed. He would not be laughing now. "John had wasted enough time here. I'm sorry to have troubled your grace. The night's watch will attend to this matter." The queen's nostrils flared.
"You still mean to ride to Hardhome? I see it on your face. Let them die, I said. Yet you will persist in this mad folly. Do not deny it."
"I must do as I think best. With respect, Your Grace, the wall is mine, and so is this decision."
"It is," Selyse allowed, "and you will answer for it when the king returns. And for other decisions you have made, I fear. But I see that you are deaf to sense. Do what you must."
Up spoke Sir Malagorn.
"Lord Snow, who will lead this ranging?"
"Are you offering yourself, sir?"
"Do I look so foolish?"
Patchface jumped up.
"We will lead it."
His bells rang merrily.
"We will march into the sea and out again. Under the waves we will ride sea horses, and mermaids will blow seashells to announce our coming. Oh, oh, oh!"
They all laughed. Even Queen Selyse allowed herself a thin smile. John was less amused. "I will not ask my man to do what I would not do myself. I mean to lead the ranging."
"How bold of you," said the queen. we approve. Afterwards, some bard will be making a stirring song about you, no doubt, and we shall have a more prudent Lord Commander.
She took a sip of wine.
Let us speak of other matters. Axel, bring in the wildling king, if you will be so good.
At once, Your Grace.
Sir Axel went through a door and returned a moment later with Gerrick Kingsblood. Gerrick of House Redbeard, he announced, King of the Wildlings. Gerrick Kingsblood was a tall man, long of leg and broad of shoulder. The Queen had dressed him in some of the King's old clothes, it appeared. Scrubbed and groomed, clad in green velvets and an ermine half-cape, with his long red hair freshly washed and his fiery beard shaped and trimmed, the wildling looked every inch a sovereign lord. He could walk into the throne room at King's Landing, and no one would blink an eye, John thought.
"Gerrick is a true and rightful king of the wildlings," the Queen said, "descended in an unbroken male line from their great king, Raymond Redbeard, whereas the usurper, Mance Rayder, was born of some common woman and fathered by one of your black brothers."
"No," John might have said. "Gerrick is descended from a younger brother of Raymond Redbeard." To the free folk, that counted about as much as being descended from Raymond Redbeard's horse. They know nothing, Ygritte, and worse, they will not learn.
"Gerrick has graciously agreed to give the hand of his eldest daughter to my beloved Axel, to be united by the Lord of Light in holy wedlock," Queen Selyse said. "His other girls shall wed at the same time. The second daughter with Sir Brus Buckler, and the youngest with Sir Melgorn of Redpool."
"Sirs," John inclined his head to the knights in question, "may you find happiness with your betrothed."
"Under the sea men marry fishes."
Patchface did a little dance step, jingling his belt.
"They do, they do, they do."
Queen Selyse sniffed again.
"Four marriages can be made as simply as three. It is past time that this woman Val was settled, Lord Snow. I have decided that she shall wed my good and leal knight, Sir Patrick of King's Mountain."
"Has Val been told, Your Grace?" asked John. "Amongst the free folk, when a man desires a woman, he steals her, and thus proves his strength, his cunning, and his courage. The suitor risks a savage beating if he is caught by the woman's kin, and worse than that, if she herself finds him unworthy."
"A savage custom," Axel Florence said.
Sir Patrick only chuckled.
"No man has ever had cause to question my courage. No woman ever will."
Queen Selyse pursed her lips.
"Lord Snow, as Lady Val is a stranger to our ways, please send her to me, that I might instruct her in the duties of a noble lady towards her lord husband."
"That will go splendidly, I know." John wondered if the Queen would be so eager to see Val married to one of her own knights, if she knew Val's feelings about Princess Shireen. "As you wish," he said. "Though if I might speak freely..."
"No, I think not. You may take your leave of us."
John Snow bent his knee, bowed his head, withdrew. He took the steps two at a time, nodding to the Queen's guards as he descended. Her Grace had posted men on every landing to keep her safe from murderous wildlings. Halfway down, a voice called out from above him.
"John Snow!"
John turned.
"Lady Melisandre, we must speak."
"Must we?" "I think not. My lady, I have duties."
"It is those duties I would speak of."
She made her way down, the hem of her scarlet skirts swishing over the steps. It almost seemed as if she floated.
"Where is your direwolf?"
"Asleep in my chambers. Her Grace does not allow ghosts in her presence. She claims he scares the princess, and so long as Barak and his boar are about, I dare not let him loose." The skin-changer was to accompany Sorin Shieldbreaker to Stonedore. Once the Wains carrying the Seal Skinner's clan to Greenguard returned. Until such time, Barak had taken up residence in one of the ancient tombs beside the castle Lichyard. The company of men long dead seemed to suit him better than that of the living.
and his boar seemed happy rooting amongst the graves, well away from other animals. That thing is the size of a bull, with tusks as long as swords. Ghost would go after him if he were loose, and one or both of them would not survive the